Welcome, everyone. Welcome back for the people who are here for the summer course, and welcome to the people who have joined now for the Elul program. In the summer course, we were looking through some texts in the beginning of Parshat Mishpatim in Exodus chapter 21, and looking at them through the eyes of the commentators, and also looking to see parallels between the laws that appear in Parshat Mishpatim and various laws that appear in the ancient Near East. So we're going to be continuing on a similar theme here for the month of Elul. We will be looking specifically at one kind of text, the texts that deal with widows, orphans, and strangers in Parshat Mishpatim, and we will branch out from Parshat Mishpatim to other places. So I will now share my screen with you and we can begin. So the three verses that we will be spending a lot of time on are the verses in Parshat Mishpatim in Exodus chapter 22 and Exodus chapter 23. Beger lo toneh velo tilchatzenu ki gerim heyitem be'eretz Mitzrayim. You shall not wrong or oppress a stranger, for you are strangers in the land of Egypt. And the next verse, kol almana v'yatom lo te'amun, you shall not ill-treat any widow or orphan. There's a question of what does lechonot mean, what does lechotz mean, what does la'anot mean. Those are three different verbs. These are just the translations of the Jewish Publication Society translation. I think these are the best understandings of the text. And then in chapter 23, we have what appears to be a different formulation of the first verse. You shall not oppress a stranger, for you know the feelings of the stranger, having yourselves been strangers in the land of Egypt. So these three verses will be a focus of ours, but as I said, we will branch out quite a bit from these three verses. And I'm going to apologize in advance and tell you that today you're going to hear a little bit of a tirade from me. I don't usually go into a tirade, but you'll hear it.
As I was preparing this class, I just discovered something about these verses, about how these verses are translated,
that really bugged me, and I will try to explain to you why I was troubled by what I discovered. Okay, but before that, just point out that those of you who are in Toronto may remember Jerry Unterman, Rabbi Dr. Jeremiah Unterman. He was the director of the Board of Jewish Education in Toronto for a few years. A few years ago, Jerry Unterman wrote a book that I think is a really good book called Justice for All, How the Jewish Bible Revolutionized Ethics,
and was published by the Jewish Publication Society and the University of Nebraska Press.
The book's goal is to demonstrate by substantial evidence derived from various sources, Sumerian, Egyptian, Babylonian, Hittite, Ugaritic, Assyrian, and of course biblical, that the Jewish Bible not only changed the course of ethical thought, but advanced it far beyond ancient Near Eastern society and religion in key areas. That's a summary of Jerry Unterman's book. And I wrote a review of the book, and here, those of you who want to read my review of the book, it's a positive review. I think it's a very...
Excuse me, Rabbi Lokshin. There's something not so great about the sound. Maybe if you moved that microphone a little bit further away from your mouth. Quite a few people have been commenting on the sound.
Thank you. Move it away from my mouth, you're saying?
Yeah. I think so. I don't know.
Okay. Or I could try without this microphone. I could try with just the microphone of the computer. Let me know what you think.
If this is better, or if I should try it with the microphone of the computer. for those of you who are interested, you can read the book review that I wrote about the book. Jerry Unterman's thesis is that the Hebrew Bible was really a revolution in attitude to the disadvantaged groups of society. And that you can't find verses like this about the strangers and about the widows and about the orphans in any society before the Hebrew Bible came along, or at least not in the, compared it to the ancient Near East. You didn't try to do a study of literature from around the world, but in the setting that the Israelites lived in, there was nothing like this. And I think he does an excellent job of comparing the material in all of these societies that are close geographically to the Israelites. We have literature from these societies that's contemporaneous with the Bible, and we have literature that's even older than the Bible, and you don't find things like this in that literature. That's the thesis of Jerry Unterman's book. I just quote a little bit from one of the things that I wrote in my review of the book. Unterman reports a conversation that he had with a scholar who wrote that the Sumerian and Babylonian law codes protected strangers to the same extent that the Bible protected strangers, a conclusion that Unterman feels is entirely unsupported by evidence. When Unterman asked the scholar how he could have come to such a conclusion, the scholar answered that when he wrote that book, he was rebelling against the strict Christian upbringing that he had received in his parents' home, and he was looking to prove that the Bible was nothing special. So there are a lot of people out there who are trying to prove that the Bible is nothing special, and that when you compare it to the ethics and the laws of the countries around them, it's more or less the same thing. And of course, those of you who studied in our sessions in the summer saw that there are some definite parallels. The idea of half damages for damage that was done by an animal of yours, when the logical position is either you're responsible for all the damages or you're not responsible at all. But this idea of half damages seems to have been a legal principle that was part of the legal outlook of the ancient Near East, and it shows up in the Bible too. But there are scholars who have a kind of chip on their shoulder against the Bible and want to say that the Bible is nothing special, that if you just study Assyrian and Egyptian texts, you will find that they are basically making the same kind of point. Now, of course, you could argue the opposite point and say that there are certainly a lot of people out there who are trying to prove just how unique the Bible is. And I admit that I'm one of those people who thinks that the Bible is very different from the literature of the ancient world. And I think that Jerry Unterman is right, that it's verses like this that show the difference between the middle of a law code, in the middle of a law code that talks about torts and murder and accidental murder and negligent murder. Suddenly we have laws in here that say you have to take care of the weak people within society. You won't find that in the ancient world. Okay, so I put my cards on the table. I think that the Bible is different. Okay. All of this is for an introduction to the way this verse was translated. The verse about widows and orphans was translated in a translation called the Contemporary Torah, a gender-sensitive adaptation of the JPS translation, which was published in 2006. I have to admit that I had never heard of this translation of the Torah until very recently. And I asked around a lot of friends of mine who teach Torah, and they hadn't heard of it either. However, this translation has become a very influential translation, because here's a screenshot of Exodus chapter 22 from Sepharia. Sepharia, if you ask them for the English translation, I'm sure a lot of you, if not all of you, use Sepharia, and it's a wonderful resource. I use Sepharia almost every day as a resource, but the default translation, you see,
I know it's in tiny writing at the top of the screen here. It says Exodus 22, the Contemporary Torah, GPS 2006. Let me just tell all of you who use Sepharia, you can change this.
If you just click on where it says the Contemporary Torah, it will give you a list of translations that are available, and you can choose whatever translation you would like. And for those of you who have Sepharia accounts, if you choose one time that you don't want to use this translation and you want to use the standard JPS translation, it will remember your decision whenever you're in your account. But if you aren't,
if you're just signing into Sepharia without having an account, then this is the translation that you will get, the translation of the Contemporary Torah. So this has become
a very powerful translation in the Jewish world, because Sepharia is a powerful and important tool that Jews use in their studying these days. So what does it mean to have a gender-sensitive translation? So here's an example from Parshat Mishpatim, not our verses. Let me again put my cards on the table. I'm all in favor of gender-sensitive translations, that if you could translate the Torah without having too many he's and him's and his's, it's much better to do it that way. And so here we have the verse, Yimchabol tachbol salmat re'echa ad-bo ha-shemesh t'shivenu lo ki'ich suto l'mata ki'sim lato l'oro b'mel shkav b'hayak yitzak elai v'shamati. So the old JPS translation, the old new JPS translation that started in the 60s and finished, the project was finished in
1985. You can see, I highlighted in red here, there are a lot of hymns and he and his's here. If you take your neighbor's garment and pledge, you must return
it to him before the sun sets. It is his only clothing, the soul covering for his skin. In what else shall he sleep? Therefore, if he cries out to me, I will pay heed, for I am compassionate. There's no doubt that the Bible also thinks that this rule applies to a woman. It's not just if your neighbor is a him. If your neighbor is a her, this rule applies also.
When I was a kid, they taught us that when you want to say him or her, you just say him, and it includes him or her.
And these days, we try to come up with a translation that doesn't make people assume this. We occasionally see documents that say, every time it says he in this document, he or she is implied.
But you see how the Contemporary Torah tried to translate
the same passage in a way that is gender sensitive. If you take your neighbor's garment and pledge, you must return it before the sun sets. Is that decent English?
Yeah, it's decent English. It left out the translation of
the word lo in the Hebrew, tishivenu lo, at the end of the first verse there, which in the Gemara,
they actually learn something from the fact that the word lo isn't necessary. You could just say
Shivanu in Hebrew,
but since Bible translations are usually trying to get at the pshat, so that's fine. You must return it before
the sun sets, and instead of saying you must return it to him, so it becomes more gender sensitive. I'd say that the next little section here becomes a little clumsy. The attempt to make it gender sensitive. It is the only available clothing. It is what covers the skin. It's just hard to say this without using the pronoun his. It sounds a little funny in English, but it is more gender sensitive to remove the his. Is there, it is the only available clothing. It is what covers the skin. And what else shall, and here they don't have any choice except to put in the words your neighbor into the text instead of the word he. Therefore, if that person, Yitzhak, if that person cries out to me, I will pay heed, for I am compassionate. So here's an example of how the contemporary Torah just basically used the translation of NJPS, the New Jewish Publication Society translation, and made it more gender sensitive. So part of the problem is finding gender sensitivity in the verses in the Torah that deal with
people, but also we have the same problem with God language.
The famous verse towards the end of the Devarim, we'll be reading in a few weeks.
So the NJPS translation
has a few male
pronouns in the
translation. The rock, his deeds are perfect, yea, all his ways are just. A faithful God, never false, true and upright is he. And I thought the contemporary Torah did a fine creative job of removing the male pronouns from their translation here. The rock, whose deeds are perfect instead of his deeds are perfect. And change the syntax here a little bit, but the meaning doesn't change at all.
The rock, whose deeds are perfect. Yea, all God's ways are just. This is what a lot of us do when we try to avoid using masculine pronouns about God. We just use the word God a lot and not use a pronoun, so not have to make a statement of the maleness of God.
Yea, all God's ways are just. A faithful God,
never false, true and upright indeed. I thought that was very creative. Instead of true and upright is he,
true and upright indeed. Is it a precise translation? It's not a precise translation, but it's a creative way of trying to present
the text in a more gender-sensitive way. So,
again, to review,
why am I talking about this? Because the contemporary Torah, this new translation that you find in Sepharia as your default translation of the Torah into English, unless you change it.
So I want you to know
there are a lot of good things going on in that translation. However, what else does the contemporary Torah do?
I read the whole introduction to the translation.
Dr. Lakshin, sorry.
Yes.
I think some people are still having a bit of trouble hearing. Others aren't. I turned on the live transcription, and if people prefer to not see that, you can turn that off on your own screen. I don't know. I was wondering if you wanted to try with the microphone on your computer.
Okay, I'm trying that now, and you'll tell me how that works. Please interrupt if you want me to try something else.
Okay.
Can you tell us how to turn off? How do you turn off the words?
I think it looks different on your screen than mine, but in the toolbar at the bottom of your screen, there should be an option somewhere.
Not mine. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so that's one really nice thing that the contemporary Torah translation does, but they do some other things, and it's not quite clear to me what principle caused them to do the other things that they did with the translation, and why am I going off on this whole tangent about the contemporary Torah? Because now we will see what they do with our verse about widows and orphans in Parshat Mishpatim. So here we are. This simple verse here, Kol Almana V'Yatom Lo Ta'anun, the JPS translation, who shall not ill-treat any widow or orphan. The contemporary Torah says, you communal leaders shall not ill-treat any widow or orphan. Why am I so troubled about this little translation here? Because I'm convinced that one of the great things about the Bible is that the Bible believes that these ethical responsibilities about widows and orphans and other ethical responsibilities apply to everybody, not just to the communal leaders. So that's what they write there in the translation. And then they, okay. Before we look at the footnote, they have a footnote. You can see there's a footnote there where they're going to explain why they think that this verse is directed to communal leaders. But, you know, there are a lot of yous here in Parshat Mishpatim. When you acquire a Hebrew slave, you shall not tolerate a sorceress. You shall not rob or oppress a stranger. If you lend money to my people, if you take your neighbor's garment in pledge, you shall not revile God. You shall not put off the skimming of the first yield of your vats. You shall give me the male firstborn among your children. You shall be holy people to me. In none of these yous did the contemporary Torah think, we better explain who you is.
And I always assumed that you, in all of these verses, is you, Jew, reading the Torah, listening to the Torah.
You, each and every one of you, and you shall not ill-treat any widow or orphan. That's, you know, like directed to all of us. So here's what the contemporary Torah wrote in their footnote. You communal leaders shall not ill-treat any widow or orphan. They write, in ancient Israel and the Near East, the responsibility for assisting and protecting widows and the fatherless was understood to rest upon local householders, elders, priests, and the kings. See, for example, these verses in different biblical texts in Zechariah, in Ezekiel, in Yeshayahu, and in Yirmiyahu. So there are two points to what they say here.
I thought I heard the word monkeys.
They are saying here in the footnote that it's the same in ancient Israel and in the ancient Near East. And that we can see from inside of the Bible that taking care of the widows and orphans was the responsibility of communal leaders and not of, I guess it means, and not of every individual Jew. Okay, so there are two parts to the argument, the internal biblical argument and the comparison to the ancient Near East. And so they cite, you can see this in the verse in Zechariah. They say, so what does it say in Zechariah?
The word of the Lord to Zechariah continued, thus said the Lord of hosts, execute true justice. Okay. Mishpat emet shvotu, that could really be directed at judges. I'll agree. That could be communal leaders. The judges are supposed to be mishpat emet shvotu. But look at the continuation of the passage. The chesed rachamim asu ish et achid. Deal loyally and compassionately with one another. Is that only communal leaders are supposed to deal loyally and compassionately with one another? I don't think so. Do not defraud the widow, the orphan, the stranger, and the poor.
Do not plot evil against one another. Is this directed at communal leaders? No, this is directed at all Jews. And so the responsibility of taking care of the widows and the orphans and the strangers is clearly in Zechariah. They bring this as their proof that communal leaders are the ones that are supposed to be taken care of, but it doesn't say that. How about this passage here that they send us to in Yechezkel? Okay, it begins by talking about Nesiei Yisrael. True enough, the name Nesiei Yisrael, Ish Yisrael, Hayu Bach, Laman Shafos Damnati. Every one of the princes of Israel in your midst used his strength for the shedding of blood. Fathers and mothers have been humiliated within you. Strangers have been cheated in your midst. This orphans and widows have been wronged within you. You have despised my holy things and profaned my Sabbath.
In you they have uncovered their father's nakedness. In you they have ravished women during their impurity. They have committed abhorrent acts with other men's wives. In their depravity they have defiled their own daughters-in-law. In you they have ravished their own sisters, daughters of their fathers. Are these evils that Ezekiel is describing in this passage, are these evils specifically of the communal leaders? Is that what it's saying here, that the communal leaders did all of these things? I don't think so. It's saying that, it might be saying that the communal leaders have a responsibility to see that these things not go on there, but these are moral defects that are being committed in the land according to Ezekiel. And if you say, oh, okay, but the communal leaders have ultimate responsibility to make sure that this is going on. And that's why the contemporary Torah said here, you communal leader shall not ill-treat any widow or orphan. Well, if the same, and then you cite the verse of Ezekiel to prove this, then when it says that you shouldn't sleep with your daughter-in-law, it should also say, you communal leaders should be sure that nobody is sleeping with their daughter-in-law. But they didn't do that. In the contemporary Torah, it was only about widows and orphans that they decided that that's the responsibility of the communal leaders and not the responsibility of the individual Jews. An extremely strange choice. So I got in touch with Jerry Unterman. He's a friend of... admit that, I'm proud that the Jerry Unterman is a friend, and I asked him, so what do you think about this translation?
And so he said,
as I wrote in the book, this is just an email answer that I got from Jerry. As I wrote in the book, I agree with Rashi that Exodus 21:1 and following is addressed to the entire people. That the you in all of these passages is you, individual Jews. Further, he says, and here's the rest of his argument, there is not a single law or legal document in the entire ancient Near East which speaks to the benefit of the poor widow or the poor orphan. So that footnote is inaccurate in every way that I can think. The translation is not a translation. It is a poor commentary. So there's two parts to this argument. First of all, the biblical author is not saying that it's only communal leaders who are supposed to be taking care of the widow or the orphan. And second of all, that argument that they have in the footnote there, that in ancient Israel and in the Near East, the communal leaders were in charge of taking care of the poor widows or the poor orphans. Unterman, who wrote the book, so to speak, about the subject, says, There's
no document like this. Where did they come up with this? They just made it up
in order to have the Bible and the ancient Near East not be terribly different from one another, as far as I can see. So I got in touch with it. I don't consider myself the biggest expert in the ancient Near East. And when it comes to questions about the ancient Near East, I turn to other scholars. And so, I turn to Unterman, who wrote a book about the subject. I turn to another scholar whom I will not name because I'm going to disagree with him a little bit. And he said to me, I can find you a couple of texts in the from the ancient Near East that do show concern about the about widows and orphans. And he sent me footnotes, the two texts from the ancient Near East that do talk about widows and orphans. And here they are. Parallels in the ancient Near East about widows and orphans. So first of all, from the Law Code of Hammurabi. If a widow whose children are minors set her face to enter another house, she cannot do so without the consent of the judges. So a woman whose husband dies, and she wants to get remarried, she needs to get permission from the state authorities to get married. When she enters another house, the judges shall inquire into the estate of her former husband, and they shall entrust the estate of the former husband to the later husband and that woman, and they shall deliver to them a tablet to sign.
I wonder how you sign a clay tablet. I'm not quite sure how you do it, but anyways, they have a clay tablet that they are supposed to sign, and they shall administer the estate and rear the minors. They may not sell the household goods. He who purchases household goods belonging to the sons of the widow shall forfeit his money. The goods shall revert to the owner. What do we have here? We have a case where a man dies, and he's got orphans left there, and he's got a wife. And there's a concern that the wife is going to get remarried and run off with all the money with her new husband and the children, and she'll forget about the children from the first marriage.
This is not a text saying, telling people that they should be worrying about widows and orphans. This is a text telling you how to solve the problem of an inter-family squabble
when a woman gets married for the second time, a problem that didn't only exist in antiquity. It's a problem that existed well beyond antiquity, not both when a woman gets married for the second time and when a man gets married for the second time. It was just a way of regulating this. That's one example of a text about widows and orphans from the Code of Hammurabi. And the other example that this Bible scholar sent me to is the Middle Assyrian laws of a woman whose husband is dead does not leave her house after the death of her husband. If her husband did not deed her
anything in writing, she shall reside in the house of one of her sons whenever she chooses. Her husband's sons shall provide for her. Again, this is about inter-family squabbles of who, you know, the children saying, okay, we don't care about our mother,
and we're going to put her out on the street because we inherit from our dead father. This is not, you know, when I mentioned these to Unterman, he said to me, look at the precision of his language. There's not a single law
or legal document in the entire ancient Near East which speaks to the benefit
of the poor widow or of the poor orphan. But the Bible is always talking about and always concerned about the poor widow and the poor orphan, and without any apologies and disagreeing with the contemporary Torah, it's the responsibility of every one of us Jews, according to the Torah, to be
taking care of the
poor widow and the poor orphan, and it's not just the responsibility of communal leaders. And let's take a look at other verses in the Bible that talk about widows. I will act, Malachi is saying, I will act as a relentless accuser against those who have no fear of me. The ones who
practice sorcery, who commit
adultery, who swear falsely, who cheat laborers of their hire, and who subvert the cause of the widow, the orphan, and the stranger, said the Lord of hosts. People who, so the first example, sorcery, and adultery and swearing falsely
are one category, but then also we have people who are in positions of power against and they can use their power
against the laborers or against the widows or the orphans and the strangers. And we have so many verses in the Bible that talk about including the widows and the orphans in your celebrations. When you reap the harvest in your field and you overlook a sheep in the field, do not turn back to get it. It shall go to the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, in order that the Lord your God may bless you. So this isn't just the widow and the orphan who are in my family
that I have to be responsible for taking care of the weak people who are in society. More verses. This is, and I'm not giving you by any means
all of the verses about widows that you can find in the Bible. Then the Uvahale Viki and Lochelet Menachalai Machla Ger Vayaton Almana Asher Bisharecha Bachlu Saben Laman Yivarechacha Asher Lokecha. Then the Levite who has no hereditary portion as you have, and the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow in your settlements shall come and eat their fill, so that the Lord your God may bless you. Another one like this in chapter 26. Those are verses that we either read recently or will be reading in the coming weeks in the Torah reading. When you have set aside in full the tenth part of your yield in the third year, the year of the tithe, and have given it to the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, that they may eat their fill in your settlements. So we see that the Torah filled with these laws, but are laws not just for the community leaders, but for everybody, telling everybody what it is that we should be doing to be taking care of the widows and the orphans in society. And a couple more verses about widows in the book of Iyov, in Job, we see that both Job's friends and Job understand the importance of worrying about widows and orphans. One of Job's friends, and I use the word friend advisedly and in quotation marks, who is trying to explain to him why things are going bad for him, he says to him, it's a shocking thing for him to speak as strongly as this to Eeyore, you know, after he read in the introduction to the book that Eeyore was righteous. You know that your wickedness is great. You do not give the thirsty water to drink. You deny bread to the hungry. The land belongs to the strong. The privileged occupy it. You know, you've got privilege, Eeyore, but you're acting on the basis of your privilege, and you're not taking care of the people, the weaker people in society. You've sent away widows empty-handed. The strength of the fatherless is broken. You know, if people come to you, Yitomim, orphans come to you, and they go away broken because you didn't help them. Therefore, snares are all around you, and sudden terror threaten you. That's why you're suffering, Eeyore, because you didn't do the things that you were supposed to do for the widows and the orphans. And then, a couple chapters later, Eeyore, again,
saying, as he does constantly through the book, I don't understand why bad things are happening to me. I did what it was that I was supposed to be doing.
He says, I saved the poor man who cried out, the orphan who had none to help him. I received the blessing of the lost. I gladdened the heart of the widow. So, you know, throughout biblical texts, through the Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim, the idea of that the individual is supposed to be worrying about the widows and the orphans and the strangers is made perfectly clear in the biblical text. So,
that's why I'm so troubled, and that's why I went into this tirade against this translation, the contemporary Torah, in their decision to say that you has to refer to community leaders. But now, let's back up a little bit. I showed you that slide way back here. Let me find it. All these yous. When you acquire yous, you shall not tolerate, you shall not wrong. If you lend money to my people, but as all of you who have studied Hebrew
for even a week know, that there's a difference between you singular and you plural in Hebrew. There is in almost every language in the world a difference between you singular and you plural. We English speakers tend to not pay attention to it unless we're reading an old text which uses thee for singular and you for plural. But in our current English, you can't tell the difference between you singular and you plural. So as I pointed out in that slide there, there are a lot of texts with you in them in Parshat Mishpatim, but this is the only one, or at least the first one, where you appears in the plural. Kol almana v'yatom bo te'anun. There's this shift to the plural.
Now, what's the significance of this shift to the plural? Why were all the yous up to this point in the singular, and this one is in the plural? So Menachem ben Chizkuni, he's really just paraphrasing a comment that he saw before him.
The Chizkuni commentary on the Torah is really Professor Sara Yefet of the Hebrew University has described it, wrote an article about it and called it a perush compilatori, that it just compiles other commentaries on the Torah into this commentary. But I like the way that he phrased it here. Lo ta'anun, he writes, mitzvah zo ketuva b'lashon rabim ma'she'en kem b'chol ha'dinim ha'ktuvim b'parasha zo.
This
mitzvah alone of all the laws here is written in plural. For everyone can be considered to have sinned in this way, even those who did not themselves belittle the widows and the orphans. He understands l'anot as to belittle. We'll see that there are many different ways of understanding what it is that you're not supposed to do with widows and orphans, but simply saw this being done and remained quiet without protesting. You can't be an innocent bystander, says Fispuni, when it comes to widows and orphans, even if you didn't do something negative towards widows and orphans, if you saw that being done, and you did nothing about it to try to fix the situation yourself, there's communal responsibility for creating a society where widows and orphans are treated well. And if you don't if you live in a society where widows and orphans are not being treated well, even if you are not responsible for the ill treatment, you have a certain level of responsibility, says Chizkuni. There is a shift within the text. We will talk at length about the verses that follow, Kol Almana V'Yatom Lo Ta'anun, but for now, all we notice is that it says here, you, plural, shall not ill-treat any widow or orphan. If you, singular, do mistreat them, im ane te'ane oto. So the te'anun, everybody knows some Hebrew grammar, te'anun is you, plural, and ane te'ane is you, singular. So there's a shift ostensibly, it shouldn't be going on
in the text. The text should be consistent, either talking about you, plural, or
about you, singular. If one person afflicts an orphan or a widow and no one comes to their aid, all are punished. That's what Ibn Ezra says. That it's not that different from what we saw here from Chizkuni, that if you live in a society, you tolerate people misbehaving towards widows and orphans, then you are responsible. And so Chizkuni is presumably expanding on this idea here from Ibn Ezra, says the shift here from the plural to the singular, imahadya aner ve'enozer ha'onesh al kulam. That we have to create a society where the disadvantaged people in society will be well taken care of. Or all of us who didn't create a society like this, all of us have a certain responsibility. And now we see something that almost looks, I don't think it looks the same as, but it almost looks like what we saw
from the contemporary Torah. Shadal, Samuel
David Luzzatto, 19th century Italy.
Here's his comment here on the
plural form here. B'lashon rabim, tzivui l'chlal ha'uma, klamar, l'shoftim she'asu mishpatam, v'lo yanichu l'shum yachid she'ye'ane
amana
v'yatom, בלי שיהיה מאנס, ולפיכך בא העונש על כלל האומה, והרגתי אתכם בחרב. The Hebrew is in the plural, says Shadal.
The command is to the entire nation, which means that the command is to the judges who will decide their cases. So it's in that sense, it's to the leaders of society to make sure that the individuals in society are behaving the way they should behave towards the widows and orphans. Now, again, I don't think that this is what the contemporary Torah is suggesting, because, you know, the leaders of society have responsibility for making sure that that all of the laws of society are being kept. And so saying that specifically this law is directed to the communal leaders is a little bit difficult from the perspective of, when you look at that translation of the contemporary Torah. But here the idea is no individual is allowed to mistreat a widow or an orphan without being punished. And so that's why the text here goes back and forth between the plural and the singular. So the first verse is, Kol almana v'yatom lo te'anun in the plural. And then the next verse is in the singular. Im ane te'ane oto in the singular. And then in the continuation it says,
the microphone was about this.
Haragti etchem. God says that he will become angry and he will kill you, you plural. So Shaddal is explaining this back and forth between the plural and the singular. That there's a responsibility, again, there's a responsibility of society as a whole to make sure that every individual in the society is doing what is in his or her power in order to protect the underprivileged people within society. And so I think we have seen today enough evidence to show that the Bible is saying something new and interesting and strong about the responsibility of all Jews to be worrying about the disadvantaged people within society. And as we go on in future weeks, we will see more detail about this. We will, next week, we'll get back to the stranger. We will come back to the widows and the orphans as time goes on. Also, but next week we'll move on to the strangers. I apologize again for the fact that there were difficulties with the sound. We'll see what we can do with that. And since I'm in a different place, let me look through the one person wrote to me and said, could you please elaborate on this? Somebody wrote to me a direct message. The poor, there's no question that the Torah does worry about the poor. I wasn't going to going into detail about the poor in this series of lectures, but it's not at all difficult to find la'chicha la'niyecha le'bionha ba'aretzecha, verses like this that make it clear that there are responsibilities for the poor people in society. Divorced women, you know, it's hard to find texts to talk about this. I will relate to this. And, you know, there's some specific texts about rules that apply to widows. Like
we'll see the text in either 2 weeks from now or 3 weeks from now. We'll see the text that says that when you take you're not allowed to take a pledge of a garment from a widow. And there's a whole discussion in the halakhic literature about whether the same thing applies to a divorced woman. There, but it's only in the last few generations that people started asking that question. I don't think there was as much divorce in ancient times as there is these days. In fact, I'm certain that there wasn't as much divorce in ancient times as there is today. And there is, that's
part of the reason, I guess,
why there is a paucity of literature on this subject. Okay.
Somebody writes, gender neutral is good, so long as what is being discussed applies equally to women. So can a woman take a garment from men as a pledge? Yes, okay, you're absolutely right. You know, there are
various laws where the gendered nature of the law is, that they, when they say that a man shouldn't be taking a garment from a woman, from a widow as pledge for a loan, was the law meant to be gender neutral? Was it also saying that a woman shouldn't be taking a garment from a man who's a widower? Probably not. It is probably a gendered law. But that one example there of that verse, in Chabol Tachbol Salmat Re'echa Ago HaShemesh Shishivenu Lo, if you take a garment as pledge from somebody who's poor, you should give it back to them before nightfall. Presumably that's not a gendered law. And so the question is, I admire the attempt to come up with an elegant translation of the text into English that wouldn't be gendered.
Okay. The Septuagint and the Vulgate have shown us that changing the translation changes the meaning 100%. But the translation, there wasn't really a translation. You know, I'm sorry to keep harping on how upset I am with this translation, but the idea that of all the yous in Parashat Mishpatim, and there's so many of them, they didn't feel any necessity to explain who the you was. And Davka, for widows and orphans, they say, oh, this is talking about the communal leaders. Take care of the widow is a high crime, just like adultery. Susanna writes 100%. It's right there, together with adultery and incest and those terrible
crimes. That's what Ezekiel is saying.
Gail asks,
widows and orphans can be Jewish or not?
Most of the biblical texts were assuming that Jews would be living in a Jewish society. And so when they talk about widows and orphans, the
assumption is that it's widows and orphans in your society.
On the other hand, you know, let's remember
the book of Ruth, when Ruth shows up in Israel. You know, she's given the privileges. According to tradition, she converted, but there's nothing in the biblical text itself about conversion. And she shows up and she's given the same privileges that are given to every needy widow in society. The ger, a stranger to which these laws refer, alongside is not Jewish. Perhaps this is telling. Nathan says, and we will talk about that next week. The ger, stranger. The assumption is that most of the people in society are Jewish, but there's the occasional ger, the occasional stranger there. But the question is, when they talk about widows and orphans, were they referring to Jewish ones or not? Are there commentaries that explain harming of widows and orphans as including other vulnerable members of the community?
or is it meant to be specific? I think that it's specific, but to extrapolate from this, from other to other members, vulnerable members of the community, makes perfect sense to me. These are the examples. The biblical legislator understood that these are the vulnerable people in society, and so that's the ones who are being discussed here. For example, individuals with physical,
cognitive,
or developmental challenges. I totally think that it is in the spirit of these laws
to expand them to people with these kinds of challenges. Any evidence of punishment or mistreatment of widows and orphans?
I don't know of any, but that just because I can't bring you proof doesn't mean that it didn't occur, but I can't think, nothing comes to mind immediately. See Exodus 22, harsh punishments prescribed. The idea that that's right.
That the,
it says that God will punish severely for the mistreatment of widows and orphans. I understood the question of iPad here to be any evidence that the society actually did this. Imposing contemporary norms on ancient texts, societies is trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. I agree with you, Susanna. But still, when we try to live a Jewish life that's based on an ancient text,
it makes sense for us to try to think to ourselves, how might we try to expand this to make this relevant
for the world in which we live right now?
Marty?
Yes?
I couldn't write this in Hebrew, so I wanted to ask you. When it had the plural, it said tanun. But when it had the singular, it was anatanun. It was that extra emphasis on the singular, which you can't get or you didn't get when they translated it.
That's
right. The translation was the double. We've always learned when they double the verb.
Yep.
So it's to use singular much more. The plural is just once. But the singular, they're trying to get a message across that was lost in the translation, if I'm
right.
Not mistaken.
It's very hard to get that across. Only Everett Fox has preserved that kind of doubling in his translation. But if you look at that verse that you just quoted, so there's emphasis going on there. If you do that, ane, twice, then sa'ok yitzak, he or she is going to call out to me, and shamoa eshma, and I will certainly hear. There is this emphasis here.
On the singular.
Yes, that is saying that there's like a certain certainty that's involved in the fact that this will be happening.
I am away from home and I have to move. And so I'm going to stop the class here. Our hour is up
in another 30 seconds, and I'll see you all next week, I hope. And I wish you all Chodesh Tov and all the best. And we'll see the location that I'm in next week. If I can get a better internet connection, I'll do my best.